Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Well, this works. I just like to get started, but introduce Werner Jansen, who really doesn't need an introduction. He was here from 1963 until 1983, and a warm welcome for Werner for coming up and sharing history and stories of the village. Thank you.
Well, it's good to be back. Let me know if you can't hear me. I'll try to talk louder. I can't hear very well. I have hearing aids, but they just increase the background noise. They don't help anything else. So, but it's good to be back. I've been here a few times. Actually, 2 years ago, when Chuck and Stephanie invited me up, was the first time I'd ever been on teaching staff. So this was a new experience for me. And it was a thrill to have them invite me back and be interested in holding stories and so forth. So I'll do a little advertising now. Partially because of that experience, I decided to write my memoirs. I had enough people that said that I should write my stories down. So since I'm retired and don't have anything to do, I spent a year ago, writing my memoirs, which may be published someday and may be offered at the Holden Bookstore, depends on, because it's not an authorized version of Holden. So we'll have to see if they want to carry them in the bookstore. You know, the more mature we get, the thicker our notes have to be. I guess the reason that I can share some stories with you that are 50 years old is that I started fairly early up here. I was 24 years old when I came as manager, and actually had worked with some committees with Holden for a couple years prior to that, starting back in 1961. In fact, it was interesting that Chris mentioned that you were back on diesel electric now. I didn't realize that the hybrid wasn't even being used right now. And the first time I came up here was in September of 1961 for the dedication of the diesel electric units that are still here. I don't think you're using those right now. They're pretty small compared with what you need. But Pastor Brown from Finney Ridge Lutheran was the religious portion of the dedication. And Stan Borison, if any of you from the Seattle area, you probably recognize Stan Borison, who was on King TV for quite a personality with Norwegian songs and stories. And he was the entertainment that weekend. So that was my introduction to Holden, and I always loved the mountains. When I first came out to Seattle, I actually came out to work with Boeing. My degree is in aeronautical engineering, and I also always wanted to be a mountain climber, so I joined the Mountaineers right away and got my REI card right away and did all the necessary things to become a climber, and that's mainly about as far as I went. Although I did climb Mount Rainier with the hike house personnel that year. Steve Olsen, Olsen, is his daughter here.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And I got reacquainted with your name is Cindy. No.
Kirsten.
Yeah, Kirsten. 2 years ago when I was here, and then that sort of reintroduced me to Steve, her father, who was the head of the hike house and my climbing partner, one of them at Mount Rainier. And so anyway, it's fun to get reacquainted, with some of the people over the years. But I came up here in 1963 to start as the business manager. And at that time, we just had two administrative personnel. I don't know how many you have now, but I think it's more than that. There was Carol Hinderly was the director of Holden, and he was responsible for programming and for worship, and I was responsible for everything else, which nobody knew exactly what that was because we had just started operating, but it turned out to be quite a bit. But when there was only two administrative people, and Carol wasn't interested in anything but programming. And worship, so it made it a lot easier making decisions. We didn't have committees to work with. We didn't have morning meetings, and so we just did it. And if somebody came up with an idea, and it sounded good and it didn't cost anything, we did it, you know. So it was a great way to do it. But the one thing I thought of when I was invited to come back this year was that since the remediation is one of the main things during, you know, the last several years, I almost felt depressed, thinking that the tailings were going to be sort of hidden and gone away and regraded, and the mine building was torn down, and it got me thinking that, in the first years, the mine and the tailings were an integral part of the life of Holden, and even in terms of the innovation of what we did, some of the projects, I remember when I came up in 1961, when I came up for the dedication of the diesel electric plants, we rode on the back of the one-ton, or the two-ton truck, I guess it's two-ton, the old International. It used to be here on display. I don't know, maybe it's someplace else now, but that was the only transportation for freight and for people. So they loaded the luggage first, and then the 30 of us that came up that weekend got on the back of the truck, and Gilbert, you know, drove us up the hill. And I remember first seeing the tailings, and we're just sort of awestruck with, I'd heard about the mine and so forth, but to me, I guess it wasn't a negative thing. It was just there. It was part of nature almost at that point. And then when I started as manager in 63, I guess it took on a little bit more responsibility, because then when people complained about the dust, I at least had to give them an answer. And we have to think about it, but it became such a part of the life of Holden. And if there was no mine, if there was no tailings, there would be no Holden. So, you know, if we want to complain about, you know, what was left there and the damage environmentally, that's fine. I mean, there was environmental damage, but again, the only reason that we're here now is Holden Village is because of what's there. And in those early years, I was going to mention that our family actually grew up here at Holden. We have two children. Our daughter Christy was born in 1970, so she was 13 years old when we left here. So all of her life and schooling up until that point was here. And she came up, in fact, both our son Jeff was born in 73. And they were both born in Chelan, and then came up here on the seventh day. So from day seven on, this was their home. And they got a good education. The community life was, you know, very unusual. I mean, they experienced, you know, life reality like, you know, very few kids do nowadays. Now, the ones who are up here now probably are somewhat the same, but, the interaction of people and the problems and controversies, and, I mean, they were in a community a real community, and that's very unusual. And they also got to see their father work, which is sort of an unusual thing nowadays, too. I mean, there's very few kids that actually observe their father working. And not that fathers don't work, it's just they don't see it. And so it was a great life. And I've never really resented the mine being here. And in those early days for Holden, that was our source of materials. At the beginning, when in 1963 there was a big scrap pile, junkyard basically for the mine, and that was a marvelous source of all kinds of things for us. Maybe some of you know Dan Erlander. When he first came up here on the staff in 1966, I think it was, when he just got out of seminary, he was interested in photography, and he spent hours up there taking photographs of the old junkyard. And he had a whole slide presentation about the junkyard at Holden. And maybe some of you grew up in small towns where visiting the junkyard was a factor. I remember I grew up in a small town in DeWitt, Nebraska, and we could ride our bicycles out to the junkyard, or the dump, the city dump, And that was part of her recreation, I mean, to go through the... But that's not something that most kids get to do anymore because there's landfills and they even have fences around landfills and it's all, you know, too organized. But in those days, the junkyard at Holden was really part of the source of art. It was the source of materials. When sometimes we couldn't find a plumbing part, we would go up there and invariably we would find, you know, a valve that we could use or something, you know. And a lot of the early art, I think the Dancing Servant is still here, isn't it?
Yep.
Well, that came from the junkyard of the mine. And a lot of the whole art welding, which Terry Saturn sort of started, and Terry Saturn did the Dancing Servant, you know, people learned how to art weld, not, you know, because a professional did it, but Terry Saturn or a mechanic or somebody else was willing to show them how to weld and they would go get some metal and we didn't have to worry about OSHA or WSHA or any of the others. And so art welding was born at Holden Village. And, you know, so it was a marvelous example in a way of taking what, you know, was left by the mine and making it into something that really benefited the early community of Holden, and it was. You know, people complained about the dust once in a while, but fortunately, and I don't know if the mine planned it this way, but the prevailing winds are down the valley, and so most of the dust, you know, went down valley rather than over the village. Once in a while, it didn't work that way, but most of the time it did. So it was, the problems for the village in those years were really minimal, you know, because of the mine. It was a real benefit. You know, thousands and thousands of pictures were taken by people of the old mill, the mine. Fortunately, we didn't have any accidents in the old mill. I mean, we told people it was off limits, but there was no fence around it, and we know the kids were up there, and probably the fathers were up there too. And you know, and so that, you know, it was a great, I mean, how many places can you go and, you know, walk around an old mill, a dangerous old mill, you know? And, so it's, you know, it really became a part of the early life of Holden. The tailings, you know, became part of the innovative life of Holden too, because we, you know, in those days, we were trying to see if there was a way that we could solve the dust problem. And we didn't have a budget, but we had, you know, a lot of conversations and a lot of ideas. And, you know, we started a compost system here in the early 70s. In fact, the first compost we tried was a pastor from Duluth, Minnesota, campus pastor. He and his wife came up here, and they approached me and wanted to know if they could start a compost system, and I thought they were hippies or something. And I says, well, I don't think we're going to do composting, but if you want to go ahead and do it personally, you know, you can do it. And I wasn't into composting at that time, but I really got into it later on. And but they really introduced the first, you know, environmentally change for Holden. And after that, we had a fellow that actually had just retired from the pineapple plantations in Hawaii. He was a biologist and he had come up with a composting system. He called it the sliding air tube composting system, and I think Holden used it up until just recently when they got the mechanical systems that may not, I don't know, how are they doing okay?
Not so good at home.
Oh, okay. Well, the sliding air tube system always worked because there was no mechanical things involved in it. The only thing we added to his design was we put electric fence around it because the bears tended to get into it once in a while. But then we tried a little garden up here, which didn't always work because there were too many critters around, and we did have, you know, sort of a demonstration garden, but that was it. But then we started using compost on the tailings and taking and digging it into the tailings and planting a tree, and the tree seemed to do fine, and we planted more trees and I think we had quite a few trees growing until the Forest Service then had a contract to resurface the tailings, and they dug up all the trees and all the plants that we had planted up there and then put rocks over it. Now they're doing it again. They're digging it up and putting more rocks over it, and I think planting more stuff on it. So the tailings keep going through a lot of... Okay, this is the last time. If it's ever finished. The other thing that, you know, we kept thinking, well, gee, we've got all these tailings up there. In fact, one year we had a suggestion box. Maybe you do again, I don't know. We had a suggestion box, and one of the fellows, his name was Paul Fanning, and I still remember that he announced one coffee break. He says, we've got a new way to deal with the tailings. We're going to make Golden Holden sermon timers. And it was, like the sand timers. So he was proposing that we manufacture the Golden Holden sermon timers that would be 20 minutes, and they would use tailings, and that we would get rid of all the tailings by selling these. And that we never went into production with that, but it was... And then another suggestion, which actually did make the newsletter, I remember the one year, is that somebody proposed that everybody that came here left with a gallon of tailings. So during those 2 years, Holden probably polluted the Midwest. Because a few people did carry out. In fact, my parents from Nebraska, I think they were living in Nebraska, they felt obligated to take a gallon with them. And so there's probably little pockets of tailings at various places in the Midwest. But about that time, there was, I read, you know, and in those days, we didn't have Google. So it was literature search, and I was reading about an operation in the Caribbean where I guess there was a copper mine someplace down there, and they had come up with a process of making building blocks from tailings. And so we decided, well, maybe that was something we could do, because we were always thinking about needing to build stuff, so why don't we build them out of building blocks with tailings? So one of our retired fellows who... John Nyquist was his name. He worked with Burlington Northern all his life, and he was very precise, and he loved to build stuff and so forth. And I told him, you know, why don't we try to make a block out of this? So that was his. He dedicated, you know, all the time he had, building. He made a frame, a couple different frames, but one, you know, like a regular cement block, and then he experimented with some concrete and some lime and some, you know, various other things, and mixed in with the tailings. And I don't know if those blocks, they used to be in the museum, and I don't know if they've been saved for the new museum or not, but I hope they're still around, because they were actually, you know, building blocks that, there was only two, so we didn't build anything. But, but it was, just to indicate that the tailings and the mine, the old mine, were, you know, a part of the sort of the life of the community in those years. It wasn't as if, you know, they were negative or we were always trying to get rid of them. We started a science and technology committee up here years ago. It's still going, I think. And but ours was much simpler. And it actually started with a fellow who was the director of the Douglas Research Labs at Hanford, Donald Douglas Research Labs at Hanford. And he was up here, and we just built the saunas, the river saunas, and I don't know if they're still here or not. Anyway, that I was saying, you know, it'd be nice if we could somehow transfer heat from the sauna into the dressing room and maybe heat some water for a shower or something. And he said, we're just working on that. He says, we're working on a closed vacuum tube that transfers heat very efficiently, and he says, I think we ought to try that up here. And, you know, I said, well, gee, you know, it'd be, you know, why don't you come up and do that? He said, well, I can't afford to come up here on volunteer time. I just don't have that much time. But if we start a committee, you know, would you be willing to be on the committee, a science committee, and maybe we could come up with projects that that we could try up here. And of course, he was all excited about that. So Leo Bustead, who some of you may know, he was the dean of the School of Veterinary Medicine at WSU, and he was chair of the committee for many years. And so we really had some, you know, high-powered, you know, scientists on this little science and technology committee at Holden. And it was a sort of an invitation only. I mean, if you were a friend of Leo, then you were on the committee. Or if you were a friend of one of the others. But if we had, even like the tailings, you know, we talked one time, well, how dangerous are the tailings? And because Mary Hinderly, Carol's wife, suffered from asthma. And, you know, and she would often wear a mask in the village when it was dusty. And so we were concerned that the tailings were really a health hazard, you know. So Leo says, oh, I've got a friend who, he was the head of the Lovelace Research Foundation, I think it was. They did environmental and analysis of, you know, air pollution and so forth. And so Leo took some tailings and sent them to him. And, you know, we soon got a report back from him and said, you know, you don't have to worry health-wise. He says that the tailings, generally the particle size is big enough that, you know, it's not going to cause, if you, you know, breathe it in, it'll expel itself. I guess that's the term or whatever. But he says it'll be an irritant. So people that have asthma or people that have breathing problems, it might irritate them, but it's not going to be a health hazard. So, you know, at least we felt better based on that we weren't living in a dangerous location. Larry Collins, who was a geologist from Thousand Oaks, I don't know if he's been up here recently, but he was on the...
A couple years ago.
Oh, yeah, he was on the faculty frequently. And I remember one time he came up to me, and our daughter, Christy, had real red cheeks for a while. And he said, you know, I think you ought to have Christy checked. He says, I was just reading an article about some mines in Germany that he said that all the kids in the town had red cheeks and he thought maybe it was a problem with acid or something in the tailings, and it turned out that she just had an allergy probably to candy or something, I'm not sure. So there was the constant conversation of, you know, what can we do, or, you know, how can we do it, or what's good, what's bad, you know, I mean, should we let people even go up on the tailings? And of course you couldn't keep them off, so that didn't, especially the kids. We always knew when Jeff, our son, had been up on the tailings because his pant legs were all yellow, you know, and we'd ask him, well, you were on the tailings. No, no, I wasn't up there, I wasn't up there. Another project that we used the tailings for was that in those early years, well, up until recently, Holden has always had problems with the sewage system. It's been one of the thorns in the flesh, you might say. And anyway, we almost got closed down by the health department because the septic field that we had at that time, which was down below the schoolhouse or Narnia, had failed. And I got a letter from the director of the Chelan Douglas Health District, who happened to be the wife of Henry Schwecke, who was the fellow who basically built our hydro for us. So we had contact there. Anyway, she said, you know, we're gonna close you down if you don't do something about that because it's a health hazard. So I knew that during the mining days, they'd actually used tailings number two, which I don't know if there is a tailings number two anymore. They're all sort of together, I think. But anyway, tailings number two was the largest of the tailings, and the mine had pumped sewage up on there at one point, and I never heard the history of it, but I knew, I mean, the pipes were still there. And so we started putting together a plan of having settling ponds up on the tailings, which would, of course, moisten the tailings, and then we were going to irrigate the rest of tailings number two out of the lagoons. And I'd gone to the Seattle Library because we were trying to find a plant that would grow in a I guess it was low pH soils, which the tailings were. And it turns out that the Jerusalem artichokes or sunchokes, you know, they'll grow in wide range of pH soils, either high or low. And we were also interested in trying to find a crop that would grow up there that, you know, we would get some value out of. And we weren't thinking of eating the Xerusum artichokes, the tuber, you know, maybe some of you have eaten them. We actually like them. But you can make ethanol alcohol out of either the stalks or the tubers. The tubers are high in starch, the stalks are high in sugar. And so we figured that, gee, we solve our sewage problem, and we'll grow Jerusalem artichokes, and we'll make ethanol alcohol, and we'll power at least our local vehicles. We probably wouldn't trust, well, in those days we had primarily gasoline buses, now I guess you have diesels, but you know, like the garbage truck and some of the local, you know, trucks in the village and vehicles, we would fuel with ethanol alcohol. And one of the young fellows who was up here at the time, you know, he came up to me after, I guess I was talking about this, and he gave me a check for $2,500 to buy a still. And we found a company that was making stills down in southern Washington. It's called the Revenuer. And he had been in jail because he was making the wrong kind of alcohol. But he was out now, and he decided to get into business. And he had, right at that time, it was really a good business. So I actually went down there and visited him, and it looked like a revenuer. But it was a wonderful still, and the $2,500 covered the cost of a 25-gallon electric still. And so since we had our own hydro plant, we had free electricity, and we were going to produce ethanol alcohol and, you know, with the tailings. And we actually had this sewage system designed then by an engineering firm in Portland, Hannah Ross and Sporzine, and one of the partners had frequently been up here with his family, and so that they had a personal interest in Holden, and they designed the sewage system, and we actually got it approved by the Forest Service and the Department of Ecology, or the Health Department, I guess it was. And about that time, I left, and then the next administration, they decided not to go with that system, and you know, maybe in the long run, it was the best decision, but in a way, it was too bad, because it would have been neat to, you know, have the sewage system solution with the tailings growing through some artichoke up there and then getting fuel alcohol. And, you know, it was just, you know, and so I guess those type of things, you know, we're going to miss, or you're going to miss not having the tailings to, you know, to work with. And but, you know, the whole thing with the mine, again, if it wouldn't be for the mine, we would, you know, we wouldn't be here. And, those type of things, you know, just stimulated the thoughts for, you know, a lot of people. I mean, even we had the number two tailings was, I think, 1,800 feet long, either 1,600 or 1,800 feet long. And we had small planes land on it a number of times during those years. And in fact, one time, and it was in the fall of the year, and our community was really small at that time, and three Piper Cubs, tail draggers, you know, flew in, landed on the tailings, and of course it, you know, it started the stories going of, you know, are they drug runners, are they from CIA, or is it an invasion by Canada, or, I mean, we needed something to stir conversation, so you know, it sort of as a result of seeing some planes land up there. I went into Boeing Field one time and talked to a charter air service. And I said, you know, we live up at Holden Village, there's a mine, there's tailings that are, and the middle tailings was really quite flat. And, you know, and he said, oh, I know where it is. He says, I've flown over that. And I said, well, is there any chance you could run charter flights from Boeing Field to the Holden tailings? And he said, well, theoretically, you know, it's certainly a possibility. And, you know, I got rates from him on how much it would cost, and actually it was quite competitive. I mean, if you would figure your drive over, you know, like for four people, and maybe having to stay overnight in a motel, and you know, you could actually do it for you could fly in here. I mean, we never did it because I'm sure that the Forest Service may have objected to it, and And you know, it probably was a bad idea, but it was again fun to check it out, think about it. And another thing along those lines that maybe you remember, in like in 1972, there was, I think, the first gasoline or fuel crisis that hit in 72, 73. And the government was interested in taking another look at dirigibles, not blimps, but dirigibles, you know, like the Hindenburg, but using helium. And so they actually had an article in Time magazine about, you know, if they could find some place that they could do a test run on passenger carrying dirigibles that didn't interfere with subsidized airline routes. And so I went one time when I was down lake, I called Goodyear, and I said, I'm interested in maybe getting a dirigible. And she said, oh, you want to advertise? No, I said, I don't want to advertise. I want a passenger carrying dirigible. And she referred me to somebody else, and they referred me to somebody else. And finally, I got the fellow who was the director of the Goodyear Aeronautics, I think it was called. And you know, he was all excited that somebody was interested in a passenger carrying dirigible. And you know, I said, well, you know, what's the maneuvering capability of a dirigible? And he said, any place you can fly a small plane, basically, you can, you know, maneuver a dirigible. And I said, well, I've got this idea that since the government is looking for a test route, that we would go from Wenatchee Airport to Chelan Airport, pick up in Chelan, and then fly up to Holden to the tailings, and then fly up to Stehekin. And you know, I could imagine that would be another thing for the staff at noon when the dirigible arrived. They would run up to the tailings and grab the ropes and pull it down and unload it back. I actually wrote to Barry Goldwater. Some of you may remember him. he was on the, I think it was the Aeronautics Committee in the government at that time, and I wrote to him, and you know, asked him if there was any chance that the government would subsidize a route, I actually got a nice letter back from him. I think it's in the museum stuff, so I hope at some point maybe it'll be displayed in the museum. But he wrote a very nice letter back about, you know, glad that you're thinking about this possibility, and he sent me, you know, like any politician, he sent a full speech that he had given to some big group, and you know, it didn't go any farther than that. But I guess the point is that you know, through those years, that the old mine and the tailings were part of the life of Holden in a sort of a special way. And it was just a fun thing to be with. And so I guess that, you know, tonight part of it was to, I guess, thank the Howe Sound Company on our behalf. You know, and sort of have a non-musical requiem of thanks for, you know, the life that Holden had during especially those early years. I think later on, then, you know, that didn't occur as much. But in those early years, Holden really needed something to, you know, to stimulate innovation. And you know, even though a lot of these ideas didn't materialize, it created a lot of conversation in the village. And it was a lot of fun even from a practical standpoint, you know, all the metal that we got out of the junk pile before the Forest Service, you know, I mean, some of the construction, some of the art projects, the altar in the village center, Arnie Flotten, if some of you are from St. Olaf, Arnie was the first head of the art department at St. Olaf. He was up here on faculty, and Carol asked him to design an altar for the village center. I think part of the instruction was that see if you could design something that sort of carried the feel of the mine as well as the valley and so forth. And so Arnie, you know, went up to the mine and walked around and found these old beams that were, you know, shoring beams from the mine, and brought them down and designed this altar, which is still being used, and it's terribly heavy, and so it was put on a movable platform, and you know, and then again the dancing servant, the art piece that, you know, if it wouldn't have been from, you know, mine scraps, you know, some of those things wouldn't have been done. There were other people that learned to arc weld up here as a result of the availability of, you know, materials like that, which didn't cost anything, you know, and that was the ideal thing. I don't know if some of you from the Seattle area, University of Washington, Dr. Ed LaChapelle, he was sort of the expert on glaciers for the world, I think. And he also then got into avalanche work because, you know, in the early 60s, the ski areas were really starting to take off, and there was more problems with avalanches, so the Forest Service was just starting in those years to pay attention to avalanches. It's hard to imagine, but that's true. In fact, I wrote to, because, I mean, we were living in an avalanche path that was about 30 miles long, and I wrote to the Forest Service and you know, said, can you send me some information on avalanches? And I think we need to learn about them because it seems like they're a little dangerous up here. And they said, well, we were the first national avalanche school is going to be at Crystal Mountain, sponsored by the Forest Service for their own personnel. And they said, you know, you're invited to come. And so I actually attended that first avalanche school. And Ed LaChapelle was one of the speakers there. Anyway, we invited him up then to, you know, be on faculty up here. And his son, who was just, I think, you know, 18 at the time, he came up with him and learned to arc weld. And I think that if I understood that he actually went on as a professional artist and had a studio in Seattle someplace, I think Ed LaChapelle, the father, has died, but and I haven't, you know, had any contact with the son, but that's what I've been told. So, I mean, there's, you know, the number of people that have learned, you know, some of those things up here and gone on as artists or photographers or, you know, whatever. And, you know, the old mill, and that was, you know, stimulating grounds for, you know, a lot of that things. And I think one of the interesting things that I always thought about Holden is that, you know, we started the pot shop years and years ago, and some of these things were started not because anybody had a great idea that, you know, like the pottery shop would be a great thing for Holden, but Carol Hinderly, the director at that time, was interested in getting he was the president of Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa, out here, because Carol was from the old Norwegian, the ELC, I guess it was, and so that they were trying to get, you know, people from the old ALC, you know, I mean, in those days, they were still all separate, and we were trying to get Holden to, you know, to bring everybody together, and anyway, so Carol found out that the president of the Wartburg Seminary was an amateur potter. He was very good, but, I mean, this was his field, and so Carol contacted him and said, we've got a pot shop at Holden, will you come out and run it and instruct? And, of course, we didn't have a pot shop. But we found out that he was going to come then, and so Carol said, you know, we need to get a pot shop. So that was how the whole pottery, you know, thing got started. And at that time it was in the old schoolhouse, and we bought an electric kiln and a potter's wheel, and so Dr. Ewald was his name, was the president, and he came out and for that summer and did some beautiful, you know, work with you know, plaques I don't know if there's any around anymore, that he did one that was the symbol of Holden in those early years, mounted on rough wood that, again, came from the mine. And But that's how the pottery shop got started. And people would come here and, you know, they would have no experience to begin with. They would go down to the pot shop, and before the end of the week, they were making pots on the potter's wheel. And, you know, it was a marvelous thing because, you know, if you go to the university and take, you know, pottery classes, and this may not be fair to the universities, but this is my take on it. You know, the first thing you do is have to learn about the chemistry of clay. And then you have to learn about the dynamics of the potter's wheel or whatever, you know. And here, all you have to do is go down to the pot shop and put some clay on and get some instructions on, you know, how it's best so that it doesn't wobble and fall all over the place. And so, you know, a lot of people got started with projects such as the pottery just because of the way Holden, you know, was in those years, that, you know, you weren't expected to learn everything about it. If you were interested, you tried it, and you sat there and worked with the potter's wheel until, you know, you got it. And the same way with weaving, or the same way with some of these other things. And so the, you know, the dynamics of the community from that standpoint was, you know, was really great. And, you know, and a few innovative things then always stimulates more innovation. And, you know, we were always trying to think of ways to you know, save energy. And, again, Mother Earth News was sort of our engineering manual. If some of you remember Mother Earth News, I think that's what it was called, and the Good Earth Catalog, was it? Yeah. And that was sort of our engineering manual, and I remember we got the, you know, the copy, and it had some of the early directions on how to make solar hot water heaters. So, you know, we turned them over to the Mavericks and said, you know, build, you know, 8 solar hot water heaters, and we're going to put them on top of the hospital. I guess it's, well, no, it's called Agape, or, yeah, the hospital. And that was when we'd already put the laundry up there. And so we had these 8, or maybe it was even more than that, solar hot water heaters made from copper pipe and plywood, and I can't remember, we had it insulated, and anyway, we sort of followed Mother Earth News. And, you know, the tank was already there, and we bought a little pump and the controls for, you know, the temperature controls and so forth. And we had steam coming out, you know, the tank, and because we weren't using the water fast enough. But it was fun
again.
Pardon?
Yeah.
We should try that again.
Yeah. Well, it was an inconvenience, and I think that's the other thing because in the winter we had to take them down because the snow would have ripped them off the roof. So it was strictly a, you know, a summer thing. But, you know, and it was sort of dangerous. I can't remember you're talk about safety, talk about ladders. It reminded me about taking down those panels because they were heavy. They were plywood. And, you know, every fall we would have to take them down. Every spring we put them up. And, you know, we're using ladders the wrong way, but we survived. But it was great. And then, I mean, people that came would then be exposed to it. And this was in the, you know, in the mid-70s before, you know, solar energy was talked about, but you didn't see it too frequently. And I started giving, you know, sessions a couple times a week on various things we were doing, like the solar hot water heater and the vermiculture. We tried, I don't know if you're familiar with worm composting or vermiculture, and that worked, except that in the winter the worms don't do well below freezing, so the composting system was better to use than that. But it was another thing that people could get exposed to, and so we had a session a couple times a week on you know, just ideas for them to try in their own homes, and solar hot water was one thing that people could do, and I don't know if anybody did it as a result of their visit here, but at least they got acquainted with it, and certainly composting was another thing, you know, work that we were doing on the tailings, so it was you know, all of those things were, you know, part of the life of the community. And I don't know how we're doing on time, so maybe some of you have some questions or ideas that, I don't know, if I didn't look at my notes here. But I guess the other thing with the tailings, that this was after I was well gone from here, but I think it was in like 1992 or so, I got a registered letter. And I think it was a deposition was the official term that I was called into Wenatchee on a certain date. And they said that they wanted to, it was the mine, the lawyers for the mine, representing the mine, and the lawyers representing the insurance companies that were, in a sense, responsible financially for the cleanup of the tailings. And so I thought it was going to be, you know, an hour, you know. I got in, it was held in a conference room in one of the motels in Wenatchee, and there were 12 attorneys there, and it lasted over 8 hours, and I think it was over 300 pages of, you know, there was a stenographer, or whatever they called the legal stenographer, and so there were over 300 pages of material, and I was so mad at the end of the day, because I was, you know, all for the rehabilitation of the tailings, and both sides, you know, they were fighting amongst themselves, as well as blaming me for, you know, they were trying to find out. I mean, at that point, they were still hoping that Holden might be partially responsible for the cleanup. And I think that's what, I don't know if I helped the cause, but at least they're not responsible now, so maybe I helped. But at the end of the day, they said, well, we'll send you a copy of the notes, and which they did after about 3 weeks. And they said, you know, we'd like to have you go through it, and if we don't hear from you in a month, then we'll assume it was okay. I didn't even read it. I was so mad at the whole process I found that copy and I gave it to Larry Howard and for the museum. And I said, you know, I'm not sure if this is legal, if you put this in the, you know, for the public to see. And he said, well, we better check it out with our attorney. And I don't know if he has yet, but maybe someday that will appear in the museum. But you know, that the work on the tailings has been going on for a long time, and Holden has been involved for, you know, many years in that. And even the Forest Service, I think the Forest Service, after we tried some of our experiments up there, they were sort of embarrassed that they weren't doing anything, and they actually got a small grant one summer. They had several people come up and plant. They had, I think, you know, 6 or 8 varieties of grasses that they were going to plant up there, and we worked with them on it, and I think we helped the irrigation process and so forth, and then they had their people, you know, come up and see once what grasses did well on the tailings and with certain fertilizers and so forth. And so, to my knowledge, that was the only attempt that the Forest Service ever made on their own. But at least they did that, and they were always very supportive of what we did. The one year, again, you know, after seeing, you know, clouds of dust being blown down the valley, I think it was in the Science and Technology Committee, we were talking about, you know, I mean, maybe in 5 years they'll all blow away, you know. Leo Bustead and Al Halverson was the other one. He was in the Department of Agriculture at WSU, and he had some grad students that were working with him, and they sent one of the grad students up here, and we started the dust bucket tests, and it was, again, a no budget, where they just, you know, we had 5 gallon buckets, and so he worked out a grid, you know, starting, you know, like 1,000 feet below the tailings, or maybe the first ones were 500 feet, and then, you know, they had some, you know, on that side of the valley and some over here, and then going on down is about as far as we could, you know, comfortably walk or get to. And then he set this grid up, and I'm sure the information is someplace either with the Forest Service or with WSU. But it was really interesting because they, at the end of the season, then he came back and, you know, we weighed the dust buckets, and he determined, you know, how many tons per year were blowing down the valley. And, you know, we again, I mean, it was a zero budget, but it was interesting information. It may not have resulted in anything, but, you know, you never know on these things. You try something, and maybe somebody will pick it up, or, you know, another grad student will do it. And I think Holden has that opportunity even now to, you know, to stimulate young people that are interested in, you know, various forms of especially conservation and ecology. And, you know, I think Holden almost has an obligation, or at least an opportunity, you know, to do that, whether it's, again, with solar hot water or, you know, something else. That, you know, Holden is a great educational, you know, laboratory. And at one point, we were actually given the old Lucerne Resort that operated down at Lucerne for many years. And Missouri Lutheran layman who got acquainted with Holden from Seattle. And his family came up here frequently, and then he heard the resort was for sale, so he decided to buy it. And it turned out that the ownership papers over the years had been so mixed up that there was no way that they could ever get a clean ownership of it. So he just gave it to Holden, the whole thing to Holden, and, you know, said maybe a nonprofit can deal with it. And everybody that was sort of associated with they had issued stock, you know, some years, and, you know, and it was really a mess. And we finally got it all straightened out, so we had clean ownership of it. And we were starting to put together a plan to put a sort of a Holden annex down at Lucerne that would be more oriented towards the public. And the original Holden Museum was actually going to be down there, because we figured that then it would be available to the public. Holden people, you know, would have access to it, either coming or going or on trips down. And that's when some of you from the Seattle area might know Dr. Donaldson. He was at the University of Washington in the aquaculture department, and he came up with the Donaldson trout, which was a huge, huge trout that was developed. And anyway, we had the idea that we were going to raise trout in pens in Lake Chelan, and then we would have a restaurant down there, and it's one of its prime things would be fresh trout from, you know, from the lake. And so Donaldson was up here sort of consulting with us at no cost. I mean, he was a friend of Leo Bustead, so Leo just invited him up here. And I mean, if we had had to pay for him, I mean, we couldn't afford it. So but anyway, he came up free. And one of the problems was that Lake Chelan was so pure that, and even that's true with some of the fish, the silver trout, or I think the kokanee that's in the lake. For a while, they would never get over like 11 inches. I mean, you'd never find one that was over 11 inches because the lake was too pure. There was no food in it. So they at one point actually put in some freshwater brine, I think it was, if I remember right. And, you know, with the idea that the silver trout would then eat the brine and, you know, grow bigger and so forth. But it turned out that it was one of these things where human intervention didn't work. Donaldson, you know, said, well, you know, you could do it, you know, with pen rearing down there, and it would work well. You just have to feed it, and you'd have to make sure that environmentally you weren't, you know, polluting the lake and so forth. But I guess getting back to, you know, working with students and so forth, what we did, I went to WSU, to the architectural department, and again, we didn't have any money, but we said, you know, some of the students here, you know, probably need a real project to work on for their senior project. And so I went down there and, you know, outlined, you know, the basics of what we had in mind, and I don't know, probably a dozen students took it on as their project for that particular year before they graduated. And we had some great ideas, and which resulted then in a proposal which we, you know, presented to the Forest Service and the local Forest Service, and in Wenatchee, they loved the idea. You know, it was going to be, you know, very conservation minded, and with the, you know, the aquaculture project and solar energy to a certain extent, and the hydro plant down there, which was still operable, and I mean, it was, I think God, it was good that God prevented it from happening, but because it probably would have been too expensive for Holden to deal with. But it, what happened was that it had to be approved by the Portland office, the regional office of the Forest Service. And at least what I was told, and I don't know if this is factual or not, but that the supervisor at the regional office happened to be a Lutheran. And he was really concerned that, you know, if he voted in favor of it, that it would look like he was giving preference to Holden. And he sent two guys up from the office down there who obviously were against it. I remember they came up here and they were, you know, they were anti-religious, and I mean, it was obvious that when they were involved, we'd never get permission. And they finally decided that, they said that they didn't want Holden to have this religious experience or religious influence all the way in the valley, you know, from here down to Lucerne, and they turned the proposal down. And even the local ranger and the supervisor in Wenatchee, you know, appealed, and I mean, they really wanted us to do it, and they appealed on our behalf, but it didn't go through. And but it was again an example of these students at WSU had an excellent, you know, project to work on that could have involved, you know, resulted in something, you know, rather significant. In fact, the old A-frame, which I think is just what, storage down there now, it's not really used.
No, we use it for winter, especially when people are waiting for them.
Yeah. Yeah, that was designed by Brad Bristein was his name, and he was one of the students from WSU that worked on the Lucerne project originally. And the time he designed that, he was with an architectural firm in Wenatchee, but he had, you know, been acquainted with Holden and really, really loved Holden. And, you know, so, again, I think Holden has, you know, a larger opportunity. You know, if they, you know, can make use of it with students, and you know, to stimulate innovative thought. You know, whether it's in photography and art and music. I mean, music has always been a big thing up here. There was, just sort of a sidelight. The school up here got started as a result of the group home that Holden had for a while. There was a judge from Whitman County that was up here with his family, and he talked to us and he said, you know, most of the cases that I have in the court is working with young boys that, you know, have gotten into trouble. And he said there's no place to send them because the state group homes are always, you know, too big. They're 20, 25. They have to be that big in order for financially to work. And he said it would be ideal if Holden could have a group home, you know, like for six boys. And you know, because with a small group like that in a larger community, there was a good chance that some positive things could happen for the boys. And so, you know, we talked about it and we decided, well, let's give it a chance. And so we actually started a group home up here, and we had, it was for boys that were, I think it was 14 to 17, and it was limited to six boys. And but the state said, well, if you're going to do that, you have to have a school up here because you have to, they have to go to school. And we hadn't thought of that. So I went down to Chelan, and Cecil West was the superintendent of schools down there, and he was also a member of the Lutheran Church down there, and so he was familiar with Holden, and he was, you know, all for us starting a school up there. And as an incentive, I said, well, you know, if you'll just credit us with the instruction so that it's an official school, we'll provide the teacher free of charge. Because at that time, we had one of our summer volunteers heard that we were thinking about this. Bev Schultz was her name. She was from Wisconsin. She lives in Leavenworth, actually, now. And she says, I'll volunteer for the whole year. She was a certified teacher. And so I told Cease West, I said, we'll provide the teacher. It's not going to cost you anything if you'll just provide certification for the students. And so that first year we had Tom Flynn, I think was the name of the first Holden graduate from the high school. And Bev Schultz was the volunteer teacher at that time. The second year, then the teachers union in And Chelan said, well, you know, you can't do that. He said, if you're going to have an official school up there, and if it's going to be a teacher that's being, you know, certified and so forth, or is certified, then you have to go through the process, the hiring process, and the teacher has to be paid. She can't be a volunteer. And so the second year, then, the school had a paid teacher. And but that's really the way the school got started was through the group home, not.
This year we have 18 kids in the school. What was the size of this? What was the range of size of the school?
I don't know what the largest was, but I think the smallest was like maybe 6, and I think 12 maybe was the most that I remember that we had, and that was in 1970 or 71, and that really opened up the possibility for sabbatical families then to come up, you know, university and pastor, university professors and pastors and so forth. Because then if we had a school up here, I mean, I think we did have a sabbatical family before we had the school, and it was sort of, you know, self-taught or homeschooled, I guess. But once we had, pardon?
Oh, we're going to have 5 graduates this year.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever heard of that kind of a number?
Not in the early years. That's really great. But, I mean, another unique thing was because we needed a high school up here for the group home, through Chelan, we had grades basically kindergarten through 12th grade. And I think we were the only remote necessary school, they call it. Stehekin has a school, but it only goes up through the 8th grade. And then, in fact, I think some students in later years actually came up here, didn't they, or a few?
Not recently.
Oh,
but
yeah.
They could, because...
Yeah, you know. But they, in Stehekin, they had to send theirs down Lake as soon as they went into high school, or they... I know some of them did correspondence courses, but most of them would go down. But Holden was lucky because it had a whole, you know,
still,
kindergarten through 12th grade.
We're still the only one that graduates kids right now.
And the remote and necessary school, they state of Washington, and I'm sure, I don't know if other states, there's very few schools left in the state. In fact, I think in the Cascade School District in Leavenworth, the Plain School, the school in Plain, not a Plain school. all schools are special. they're a remote necessary school, but you know, and I don't know what the ratio is at that time. I think it was 3-1. Like if the state of Washington would pay, you know, $2,000 a year for a student, then in a remote necessary school they would pay $6,000. So. You know, in a sense, it was pretty lucrative, and Chelan School District actually got into trouble with it because the rules were that if you collected money from a remote necessary school, they had to spend that money at the school or in connection with the school. And apparently, Chelan wasn't doing that, and, you know, they ended up using some of that money that they were getting from this school system, you know, to enhance the instructions down there, and the state, through an audit some years later, found out about it, and I think the Chelan school system had a huge, I don't know, I heard it was $1 million, I don't know if it was that much, but they had to pay back to the state. But I mean, Holden School, you know, in a way it was unfortunate because the school didn't need that much per student. Because like when our kids were in school, I know our daughter Christy, she was taking mathematics from a PhD from Wartburg College, I think. And, you know, she was in the third grade, so there's very few third graders that are getting mathematics from a PhD. But that happened frequently up here. And I'm sure that's still the case when drama productions took place, it was really a community production. You know, I mean, the adults were in the production, the high school kids, I mean, the kids were in the production, so it was really a community, you know, affair, so it was a great experience for the students. So, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, and we're going to do another session tomorrow, and you're around all day, so
I'm around.
Chat with you.
Yeah.
But for tonight, you better
Thank you very much.